This public radio podcast is supported by Diana Kennedy's The Art of Mexican Cooking, the ultimate guide to creating authentic Mexican food in your own kitchen with more than 200 beloved recipes. First published in 1989, it's back in print with a new introduction.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room and Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today it's the question, can you make an instant wine expert from someone who is next to clueless? Food and Wine magazine's wine editor, Letty Teague, set out to prove that it could be done. Her student was the Rolling Stone film critic, Peter Travers. Letty tells her story, and Peter tells his. We look at Old Ways, the culinary think tank that works to keep traditions alive, well, and relevant to modern health. We get inspired picnicking ideas in New York City from New York Food Authority Mike Colomeco. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get started the way we do each week with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, one of the lesser-known, unique regional specialties of the Deep South is tamales served in a coffee can. You find these throughout the Mississippi Delta from Memphis down to Vicksburg, and they're sold in restaurants as a meal. They're sold by street corner vendors, and they're sold in little convenience stores as well. And how and why tamales got to be a specialty of this region of Mississippi and on the other side of the Mississippi in Arkansas, nobody knows for sure, but they're really good.
In a coffee can? Well, how do you eat it out of a coffee? I mean, is that sort of the packaging, or do you eat it out of
They're
it?
Packed in the corn husks, a dozen in one coffee can.
Huh.
Like a supermarket-sized coffee
can.
With the plastic lid put back on it. It's just a perfect vehicle for taking out these hot tamales. And strangely enough, it's a food that is sold mostly by black chefs in the Mississippi Delta. We have never seen a Mexican person making them.
We got a dozen explanations from different people about how tamales came to. Some say it was a Texan who came there. Some say it was a Mexican.
Huh.
It's obviously not from the migrant workers, because at the time tamales got to be popular, which is maybe 60, 70 years ago, there weren't any in that part of Mississippi.
Huh. Are they chicken? Are they pork? Are they?
Oh, that's
interesting you should ask.
Yes, because mostly the tamales you find are either pork or beef. One place that we found, Rhoda's Famous Hot Tamales in Lake Village, Arkansas, serves the best we've ever had. And we asked Rhoda what exactly made her tamales so luxurious and so sumptuous. She said it was chicken thighs.
Ooh.
Including all the skin. She said everything but the gristle. Now, that infuses them, you know, with that same kind of soul food flavor that's actually almost like schmaltz in Jewish cooking, really rich chicken fatty flavor that makes these head and shoulders above any other tamale.
And Rhoda's Hot Tamales, a wonderful little soul food cafe. And Rhoda herself is a delightful woman who spends half the time talking to you about tamales and half the time praying while she's cooking. And I don't know whether it's her expertise as a cook or her prayers, but I'll tell you, what comes out in those coffee cans is worth a trip to Arkansas.
And also, I just need to offer some practical advice to those who are eating tamales in the Mississippi Delta for the first time. You will be served these tamales either in a coffee can or on a plate, generally without any utensils. The proper technique for eating these tamales is to peel back some of the husk and use a saltine cracker to scrape out the filling.
Oh, wow. Boy, anthropologists are out there and they're making notes really, really fast right now.
Well, it's one of the strangest specialties, because it's Mexican, but it's not, and it's soul food, and it's only in the Mississippi Delta. It is truly an anthropological wonder.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, the Sterns check in here every week, but you know this. You can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Oh, and while you're there, be sure to register for our new limited-run e-newsletter and get information on its accompanying podcast. They're both called How to Eat Supper. They're based on our brand-new book of the same name. Now, each week for a limited time, we send you a new recipe from the book, and we've put together even more tips and information relating to that week's topic on the How to Eat Supper podcast. And best of all, they're both free. So, register for it all, splendidtable.org. Did you ever wonder how food writers get inside foreign cultures? I mean, the tourists could go to the same places but not get into homes or meet with experts. Now, true, a writer is only as good as his advanced research, but one organization has been a big help to many of us. It is Old Ways. Now, Old Ways organizes trips that are explorations of cultures. Sitting next to you on the bus may be a chef or an ethnobotanist or a farmer. Well, that's how Old Ways works. Old Ways was started by Sarah Bear Sinnott and Kay Dunn Gifford. Now, their new book is The Old Ways Table, Essays and Recipes from the Culinary Think Tank. Sarah Bear Sinnott joins us. Sarah, it's good to have you with us.
It's great to be here with you, Lynn.
Can you explain how Old Ways began? What was the original goal of the organization?
The original goal is put out by Dunn when he started it in the early 90s. Started from a trip that he had in China. He was with Nina Simons. It was an early trip when China was first opened up.
And Nina's the Chinese food authority.
Exactly. Yeah. He's written quite a few books about it and is also fluent in Chinese. So Dunn traveled with Nina to China with a large group of people. And they discovered that during the Cultural Revolution, a lot of the cookbooks had been burned. And there were also no middle-aged cooks. There were very young ones or very old ones. So the whole idea of preserving the old ways came to Dunn from a Confucian banquet. And he came back to Boston and started, called up his lawyer and said, I'd like to start a nonprofit educational organization to preserve traditional food ways. And that's really where we've been grounded. And it started also with the advent of the low-fat movement. I don't know if you remember in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Low-fat was big. The government had put out low-fat, and industry responded, and there were low-fat foods on every single grocery store. And Dunn really believed that low-fat was a foolish policy and would make people eat unhealthy foods, as he's certainly been proven right. And at the same time, we were looking at the Mediterranean. There had been a lot of research done on the healthfulness of the Mediterranean diet, going back to Ansel Keys and the Rockefeller brothers' studies in Crete after World War II. And so putting all those things together in a big stew, we came up with promoting and educating consumers, food writers, chefs about the Mediterranean diet, which means olive oil as a healthy fat. And that's not the low-fat movement. And rather than attacking the low-fat movement, mm-hmm. we more offered an exciting, delicious, healthy alternative. We did this through science. And then also by developing the Mediterranean diet pyramid with Harvard and the World Health Organization, but followed that by the romance of the Mediterranean diet, taking food writers like you and chefs to various places in the Mediterranean. We went to Puglia, Liguria, Morocco, Tunisia, Turkey, Italy, Spain, yeah. and brought back the romance and the foods and the preparations that made consumers understand what the Mediterranean diet is.
Am I right in thinking you didn't just do the Mediterranean diet pyramid, but you did other pyramids as well?
Yes, there are four pyramids, not just the Mediterranean diet, but there are cultures around the world that have the same kind of healthy pattern. Plant foods, plant oils like olive oil, mm-hmm. peanut oil, nuts, beans, fruits, vegetables. So there's an Asian diet pyramid, a Latin American diet pyramid, and a vegetarian diet pyramid.
Hmm. Do you feel that Always is still on track, or has it evolved in different ways?
I think we're still on track. We're always trying to stay ahead of the curve, looking at the next big thing, and I think we've continued to do that. Whole grains is something that we've really been working on, certainly part of the Mediterranean diet. Uh-huh. It's at the foundation, the bottom level. But consumers haven't over the years, no matter what our government or dietitians were saying about whole grains, they weren't really embracing it. So we started the Whole Grains Council in 2002, and slowly but surely, consumers are beginning to understand that whole grains are not just brown-colored bread, but there's a huge variety of wonderful, delicious, healthy whole grains.
Sarah, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Sarah Bear Sennett is Executive Vice President of Old Ways. She's co-author of The Old Ways Table, Essays and Recipes from the Culinary Think Tank. Now, you can find the Old Ways recipe for fresh fava bean soup on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, the side of Old Ways I get to see is the kids let out of school phenomenon. Throw together an incredibly dissimilar bunch of people who come at food from every imaginable discipline, put them in a foreign country, have them examining, lecturing, and working hands-on 12 hours a day, and then let them loose. The talk never stops. The all-nighters are common. On one trip to southern Italy, Lydia Bastianich of PBS fame convinced our hotel to give us the kitchen for an afternoon. Now, we were going to cook a banquet for the entire Old Ways crew, about 150 people. So picture this: food stars, chefs, writers, importers, and academics from around the world, and by coincidence, all women, hip deep in local ingredients, cooking nonstop, while throwing out opinions, debating techniques, and laughing a lot. We dubbed ourselves Lydia's Chefettes. And we pulled off the meal, big time. But the best part was dessert. We got Lydia to sing. Now, did you know that she originally trained as an opera singer? Then the Japanese contingent said thank you by serenading all of the Chefettes. Then the Australians went into waltzing Matilda. And at this point, my memory of the evening gets a bit fuzzy. But there was something about searching for a famous baker at 3 a.m. in a village several towns away. And then there was that business about waking up in the morning to a chunk of half-eaten bread on my bedside table. Coming up, how to become an almost instant wine expert and inspired picnicking in the Big Apple. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Letty Teague has been Food & Wine magazine's executive wine editor for 6 years, but for decades before that, she was learning about wine from the ground up. In spite of this, Letty is determined to debunk the myth that wine is hard to understand. Now, to test her theory, she took one wine idiot, her description, and set out to see if she could teach him enough basics to confidently navigate the wine world alone. Her victim was a formidable force in his own world. Letty's book title says it all. Educating Peter, How I Taught a Famous Film Critic the Difference Between Cabernet and Merlot, or How Anyone Can Become Almost an Instant Wine Expert. Letty, welcome.
Great to be here.
You have to tell us, who is Peter?
Peter, whose name you'll see more on more movie ads probably than any other human being in the world. Peter Travers is, of course, the longtime film critic of Rolling Stone magazine.
And now he's a friend?
He still is. Incredible.
After this
true.
Book, he's still a friend.
I think he's still talking to me. No, we've been friends for about 10 years, so I've known him much longer than it took me to write this book.
Yeah. What is he like? What's his personality like?
You know, he's disgustingly charming. I've never met... just appalling. Every single woman and a few men that meet Peter will say, oh, my God, he's so funny. He's so charming. He's so wonderful, much to the consternation probably of most men around him and perhaps to his wife, Robin, as well.
Well, so now you decided to take him on. You refer to him affectionately, I gather, as a wine idiot. What was this person drinking at the time that you started this project?
Well, we'll say that he had wine limitations. He had actually profound limitations. He drank exactly one wine and exactly one kind of wine, and that was what he called fatty Chardonnay. And that word, of course, the adjective was Peter alone was the only person that ever used that. And it meant essentially a really big, oaky Chardonnay.
So how did you actually begin training him?
Well, we started with six grapes. I thought, we'll give Peter something he can grasp. We'll taste these six noble grapes, and we'll start from that, sort of the basics of understanding some very simple concepts. The grapes were Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, of course, Peter's favorite, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Cabernet, Merlot, and Pinot Noir. And those are, while there's certainly other noble grapes in the world, I thought, if he can just understand those six grapes, that will be a beginning.
So he tasted those and began to be able to identify them, right?
Well, he tasted them. He was terrified, of course, of having to even taste. He couldn't even grasp the idea of tasting. I mean, I should back up and say how to hold a glass was something that we started with. How to taste, how to spit, which, of course, Peter was horrified by, which, you know, wine professionals take for granted. That's what you have to do. But Peter thought it was the most vulgar thing imaginable that I would be asking him to, you know, take wine in his mouth and then immediately spit it out. So we had to go through quite the battle just to accomplish that.
So how did he react to the six basic grapes? Could he taste the difference?
Well, Sauvignon Blanc, he really probably still despises. That was a grape that Peter created his favorite tasting word, which was ouch. And he decided that was the word that perfectly described Sauvignon Blanc and the effect of Sauvignon Blanc on his mouth. Sauvignon, to him, the highest praise he could grant it was that it gave him a lemon feeling. Peter ended up using that, which made him sound like Barry Manilow a lot of the time. They gave him a particular feeling. You know, it wasn't a taste or a flavor. It was a feeling. So,
you tried to teach him wine vocabulary, and you know, apropos of what you're saying, Peter has his own sense of language, especially as a film critic. This had to have been a riot.
Yeah, he was very resistant. Although there were some words that he seized upon, like esters, which are the aromatic compounds in wine. And when there's a phrase, when you swirl your glass, you're releasing the aromas. And mm-hmm. the technical term for that is volatizing the esters. Well, Peter decided that was the greatest thing ever, and he was going to volatize his esters everywhere that he could, and especially in the presence of Martin Scorsese. Why Martin Scorsese should be particularly treated to this volatilization of ester show, I don't know. But as far as I know, he actually did at some point volatize his esters for Marty, as Peter likes to call him. But, you know, everything, you know, evoked some sort of cinematic reference or just a shameless name drop.
Was there a connection he made between phylloxera, the wine louse that almost destroyed?
Oh, yeah. He said that's when Harvey Weinstein gets involved in a movie. It's like the effect of... of phylloxera, devastating a vineyard. He also said, when you were talking about the making of champagne, and I was describing how a big champagne house, you know, buys grapes, makes the blend, and then they take many, many lots of wine to create a blend, and Peter decided that sounded like Steven Spielberg making a movie. That he said, you know, if the champagne house just slaps their name on this blend that they've gotten from all these vineyards all over Champagne, he said, well, that sounds like Spielberg putting his name on a movie like Gremlins or Goonies. It'll just be Steven Spielberg Presents. And I said, well, that's not really the same thing. I think Veuve Clicquot and Moët Chandon would probably take issue with you.
So now you went through a year, and in the interest of, you know, the true educational process, did you try to quantify what he'd learned?
I actually did give him a quiz that appears in the back of the book, and I gave the quiz to Peter. He scored a fairly respectable 84%. As his teacher, I wish it had been higher, of course, but his essay question was quite good.
What was that essay question?
It was actually describing one of his favorite wines that we'd tasted, and it was a Hermann Weimer Riesling from the Finger Lakes. And I'm happy to say he didn't use the words feeling at all in his description of it, so Shows you how far he came.
So last question, did you create a monster?
Well, he was one kind of monster when we began. He's become a second kind of monster. No, he really, you know, Peter actually has evolved into someone, and this is what I think is key to anyone that's learning about wine, is he's evolved into someone that's that has enough knowledge that he's confident, and he can hold a conversation with a sommelier or a wine retailer so that he knows enough, he has a vocabulary outside the words ouch and feeling, to describe what it is that he likes, and he has a base of tasting experience. So you can talk to someone that may know more than you, but you know it puts you on more of an equal playing ground.
And it may mean that you don't drink just fatty Chardonnay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Discover a few other wines in the world.
Hey, Letty, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Letty Teague's monthly column, Wine Matters, appears in Food & Wine magazine. She's author of Educating Peter, How I Taught a Famous Film Critic the Difference Between Cabernet and Merlot. Now, you can take her wine quiz, the one that she subjected Peter to, online. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. As you just heard, the Peter and Letty Teague's title is Peter Travers, film critic for Rolling Stone. Peter couldn't join us when we interviewed Letty, but he's now on the phone. Peter, welcome.
No, of course, I would have strangled her if I had joined
you.
even the charming line got disgustingly charming. I don't know how to take that. Letty is the master or the mistress of the left-handed compliment.
So I gather this experience for you perhaps was slightly different than it was portrayed by Letty.
Well, you know, she's partly right. You know, there were many things. The idiot part I copped to immediately. You know, I certainly was. I did have a lemony feeling out of Sauvignon Blancs. I did only drink fatty Chardonnay. I'm guilty of so many of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the shameless name dropping. I think she used to say to me, you know, compare it to your own world, you know. So when you see somebody, ask them about what wine they drink. So, oh, wow, I feel the punch of that one. But, you know, it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. I got to taste all of this, and I got to know what was good and what was indifferent and what was actually spectacularly bad. Don't ever try any South African Pinotage. That's darn near killed me.
So was there any point here, though, where you just felt overwhelmed by it? Where you just
wanted to chuck it? In the beginning, I was overwhelmed, but Letty does not allow you to get overwhelmed. You know, she just says, there's more. She would have me in those offices at Food & Wine tasting 15 bottles every Friday at 11 a.m. because she said, that is the time when your senses and your taste buds are at their peak. So I would, of course, never spit out anything that I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
So I staggered back to Rolling Stone, and God knows what kind of reviews I wrote on Fridays. It was I would just drink these things and got to know what each grape varietal was and got to have favorites and then got to have my head turned around a little by things. Who wouldn't want to do that?
Well, that I can understand, but are you now the person at the dinner table who sort of pontificates about what's
Oh, yeah, I'm the person people can't stand. I mean, I've become that person that anybody in the world would hate. Anytime there's wine brought out, I would say, okay, let me taste it, and I'm going to tell you this about that. I'm thoroughly obnoxious and a monster, and Letty has created that person.
So what are you drinking now?
Well, you know, as she said, I do have this love of Riesling. Finger Lakes, it doesn't really matter. I just really love it. But one of the great things that she didn't mention in the interview was her introducing me to the people who make wine. It was one of the greatest things because in film, too, I often like to meet the filmmaker and how they've done it. And Suzanne Bilbao, who had from Argentina, who had come to New York and told me her story, the wine suddenly becomes part of something greater. It's more than the varietal. It's the person who makes it, how they make it, what their approach is to it.
Yeah.
And I totally love it. It's the same approach I take to movies. It's not just any movie. If it's a movie by Martin Scorsese, then it's a specific thing. It has a certain flavor. And that's how I think I learned the most about wine, by getting past what I needed to know technically about varietals and geography. And, you know, my goodness, could I go through the Côte d'Or with you? But I'm sure you don't have the time.
But you actually did do that. I mean, you actually traveled to where some of these wines are made.
We traveled and we ended in Sicily, where that was my favorite movie, The Godfather. And we went to Sicilian wines and we did so much that we tried to bring my expertise and Letty's expertise together. And I tried to teach her about the movie. And she taught me about the wine. But we went to Napa. And I watched how these people live and how they talk and how wine goes with food and their conversation about their lives. And it became that kind of art form to me when people do it well. I'm saying I no longer drink my Mogan David Extra Heavy Malaga.
Or the Fatty Chardonnay.
Well, no, I'm afraid I'm still guilty of my love for Fatty Chardonnay. I've just opened myself to the world of wine, and I'm now ready for Chateau Petrus, but Letty isn't ready to give it to me.
Perhaps the rarity might have something to do with that, Peter.
I think it is.
But it sounds like, true to being a film critic, it's the story that is getting you, as well as the wine, right?
Well, yeah, I could not, in the beginning, relate to what I was learning unless I did it in a very idiot savant way and related it to movies, you know?
Uh-huh.
I would taste a Sauvignon Blanc and I would say, this really wants to be delicate, like Lost in Translation, but it turned out to be a bad Julia Roberts chick flick. And I would write my notes that way. And then when I would get to the wine later, I would stop that and it would stop making the movie references and I would be able to make my own references to the varietals. And it was just, I can't imagine what a wonderful experience it would be for anybody to have, and that I was the one that had it is just makes Letty a grand cru all by herself.
Hey, Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Newly minted wine connoisseur Peter Travers is film critic for Rolling Stone. I want to know eating in New York. One person to go to is Mike Colomeco. On his radio and television shows, he covers the city's food scene from eating on the cheap in Hell's Kitchen to going behind the kitchen doors of great restaurants. Mike spent a lot of time in those kitchens as a chef. Mike Colomeco, welcome back.
Hey, always great to be here with you, Lynn.
There's one thing about New York I want to talk to you about. I don't think people realize what a great picnic town it is.
Because
people look at the city and they don't think about a picnic, but I know New Yorkers love it.
No, there's parks all over. You know, back in the day when I didn't have any money and I used to travel to Paris on a shoestring, you know, we'd save up money for like those 2-3-star restaurants, stay in a cheap hotel.
Right.
And we'd, you know, go buy a piece of pate at a butcher, a baguette at a baker, a bottle of wine somewhere and a piece of cheese, and we'd eat in a park. You know, I'd bring my own corkscrew. I was so cheap because you can do this on the fly. And New York's got a lot of parks. So, you know, this is an interesting question, and here's a couple of different takes on it. The you know, the mother of all parks in Manhattan, Central Park. It's huge. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's open to the public in most areas. Great place for picnicking. And if you're looking for food, the whole Columbus Circle area has really come along ever since the time Warner Towers replaced that thing that was the old New York Coliseum. The Columbus Circle used to be kind of a dumpy area because the Javits Center replaced the Coliseum and the Coliseum sat dormant. But now you've got this amazing Time Warner Center. Thomas Keller is on the fourth floor at Per Se, but he's got this beautiful little bakery on the third floor called Bouchon.
Ooh.
And it's typical Thomas Keller. I mean, he does a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but no. He makes his own cashew butter, his own apricot preserve, does it on his own pan de mie, cuts the crust off. It's to die for. They've got about a half a dozen to a dozen sandwiches that are superb, cold dishes like pâtés, soups, and pastry that's, I mean, it's arguably one of the top three pastry places in the city, and beautiful packaging.
Right.
Get takeout at Bouchon, walk across the park, and you're not going to live much better. Now, say you're downtown.
Okay.
There's a Greenwich Village has this whole British history thing. I mean, it was founded by the British and hence the name Greenwich. There's a little tiny park that's been renovated in the last 10 years called Abingdon Square. And I love it. It's named after some Lord of Abingdon or something. And who cares about the history? But it's cute. It's got seats. It's funny. It's right between kind of Hudson, just north of Bleecker. And it's this little like Brit section of town. Just to the north of it's a store called Myers of Keswick.
Myers of Keswick.
Do you remember the cat in New York that got stuck in the building for 2 weeks? Did that make national news? There was a cat.
Yes, this
is the building. This is his cat. That brings it home to your listening audience. Remember, the cat's still. I saw the cat the other day. He's fine. He's living in a shoebox.
Okay.
Myers of Keswick. They sell this. It's staffed by British guys and gals. So you walk in and everyone's like, "Hey, mate, how you do?" Or is that Australian? I don't know. All the British expats shop there. Everyone that works there is British. And I just ask them, "What's out of the oven?" Because they do all their own baking. So they've got Cornish pasties.
I think that's correct. Yeah.
That's correct. I said pasties and it's pasties, mate. Oh, sorry. Cornish pasties, Scotch eggs, all these great little typical British things with like little meats and sausages wrapped up in dough, mincemeat pies, all fresh made daily, hot. You could pick that up, wander down the street. I mean, they're like a little Tesco. They're a block from Abingdon Square. And there's a couple of blocks to the east of this, a fish and chips place called, and this is a pun, Salt and Battery. Spelled A, then S-A-L-T. You got to love the Brits. But it's like great fish and chips, and it's on Greenwich Street. And, you know, you've got this whole Brit thing going. My last suggestion, I'm going to squeeze it in, is, and I got to shout out to one of the last great delis in New York, Katz's Deli.
Oh,
go to Katz's. This is when Harry Met Sally, the famous place. Lower East Side.
Right.
Houston Street. Kind of like by Allen and by First. Grab a sandwich there to go. Anything from pastrami, corned beef, brisket. You can't go wrong. Some of the best hot dogs in the city. A big one called a Knobelwurst. It's like a big garlicky kind of a German hot dog that's great. And then go up 8 blocks to Tompkins Square Park, which is in the middle of the Lower East Side. You know, this was this famous park that for years was kind of dangerous and drug-riddled and crazy. It's completely gentrified. It's a real great piece in New York. Charlie Parker lived across the street for years. And, you know, Tompkins Square Park, it's like one of the hottest neighborhoods in the city now. You know, years ago, everyone came to this part of New York and they wanted to move north, the grandparents.
They came
to Delancey, they came to Orchard, they made enough money and they moved to the Upper East and West Side.
Right.
Now, all their grandkids have come back to Delancey and Orchard. Nobody wants to be north of 14th Street anymore. Who knew?
Should have bought back then, right?
Please, everybody's comment.
Yes, exactly. Hey, Mike, though, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike Colomeco hosts Food Talk on WOR Radio in New York City. Now, you can get Mike's picnic finds and my picnic recipe for roasted asparagus potato salad on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, going back to the Educating Peter book, this is one of the extra credit questions from the wine quiz. This is the question. If movies were ranked according to the Bordeaux wine classification system, which movie would be a first growth? Citizen Kane, Basic Instinct, or South Park the Movie? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, this one goes back to the wine book Educating Peter. It's one of the extra credit questions from the book's wine quiz. The question was, if movies were ranked according to the Bordeaux wine classification system, which movie would be a first growth? Citizen Kane, Basic Instinct, South Park, the Movie. Well, the answer is A, Citizen Kane. This first growth business goes back to 1855 when the Bordeaux-Medoc region's vineyards were ranked according to quality. Well, amazingly, the system is still in place. And obviously, Citizen Cane is definitely a first growth. It's a classic, and it's on everybody's best of list.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. You call me, tell me, and I'll be around. If it seems your friends desert you, there's
pick up that phone. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Let's get to the phones. We have Sunny calling from Minneapolis. Hey, Sunny, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about coffee.
Okay.
When I travel out of the United States, especially in Europe, coffee tastes different, looks different, feels different. It feels round. It feels golden. And no matter what I do here, I can't duplicate that.
Okay. And so you're saying, how can I get my coffee?
How can I make European coffee here in my kitchen in Minneapolis?
What kind of coffee are you making now?
I use French roast beans and grind them, or Italian roast beans and grind them. A friend suggested that I use a little chicory. I do that. And for my own taste, in order to give me some of that fullness, I even sprinkle a little nutmeg in when I ground it.
That's not a bad thing. I've done a little cocoa, too.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, again, not to taste cocoa, but just for the rounded quality.
Right. To sort of, because it looks different and it just feels rounder and golden.
You know, this is a tricky one because I have to tell you, honestly, it's the way I feel about coffee when I come back from someplace like Italy or France. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I can tell you the technical side of it. But I think there's something in here about skill. I mean, the technical side of it is that generally those beans are fresh ground moments before. For instance, I'll give you an instance. If you buy pre-ground coffee, it's in prime condition for literally 24 hours.
Okay, that's why I buy beans.
Yeah, exactly, and that's why most of us do. Now, the other thing about that is we're going to back up here. We're going to go back to the bean before it's even roasted. Okay, let's take the process. So we buy beans, right? Well, when you roast a coffee bean, that's in its prime if it's stored away from heat and light. And that blows completely buying from those clear bins that you see in so many stores. If it's kept away from heat and light, it's got 2 weeks to be in prime condition. Right? And, you know, and that's where you throw up your hands and you say, oh, boy, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like we're in a lose-lose situation.
Yeah. And then you back up to that is, what is the quality of the coffee bean before you begin all of this? And then you have to ask the big question is, what is the quality of the roasting, the skill behind the roasting? Because, you know, just applying heat to a coffee bean does not necessarily roast great coffee. It takes a lot of skill. And that doesn't mean everybody who breathes air in Europe was born with the genetic structure to roast coffee.
I was going to say, but you're alleviating my guilt of I didn't do it.
You didn't do it. No, you didn't do it. This is what I would do. Okay. If you are obsessed, and I think you are, and I get this way too, I don't drink coffee every day, but when I do, there is just got to be.
I want it to be good.
Yeah. And let's not dismiss this idea that, you know, when we're on vacation and we're in the environment, it's wonderful.
Right.
But there are people you can mail order coffee from who, when they get the order, they roast your coffee and they ship it off to you.
Really?
Yeah. And there are two that I can think of.
Okay.
One is, and these are on the website, Barrington.
Barrington.
Right. And I think they're in Vermont, Barrington's in Great Barrington, Vermont. But anyway, these people roast to order. The other place that's really interesting is a place called Terroir. Now, their big deal is that they are doing coffees from specific places, and each bean is roasted in a different way depending on the need of the bean.
Makes a lot of sense to me.
It makes a great deal of sense, and that means somebody's really studying how to roast a coffee bean. Now, there you stand a good chance of getting the cup of coffee you dream of. And you know, I think there's the good side of this obsession with coffee in the United States is we have more choices. The bad side is 90% of the people making it don't have a clue of what they're doing.
So we have to really work hard to find that other 10%.
Yeah, but the other thing is it's so nice. You know, email a credit card and bam, it's right there in the mailbox.
And well, thanks for the resources, and I'm going to see what I can find out.
Just know you're in good company, girl.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. This is really, you know, I really have to stress this. Most of the coffee we get out there is pretty lousy. It's dark roasted and whatever. When you find someone who knows how to make a great cup of coffee, just support that shop. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have David on the line from Pittsburgh. David, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn.
Hello.
Rumor has it you're a little bit Italian.
You've heard.
Yeah, but you advocate garlic so much, that question's been answered. The more important question is, are you just at least a little bit pudgy?
I consider that a deeply personal question.
But No. It's a qualification.
No. I have to say, I don't consider it pudgy. I consider myself to be a woman of great abundance.
Okay. That's good, because you can never trust a skinny cook.
That I agree with. Although, you know, I have to tell you, I do know some, and by gum, they're really good cooks.
Great.
So, David, other than deeply personal questions, if you ask me how much I weigh, it's over. I'm hanging up. Did you have any other questions to ask?
I do. One of the most well-known and enlightened Maharishis of our time said that the eggplant is the finest food for the human being. I never hear it mentioned on your program. And I wonder if you could give us some great ideas about preparation of eggplant.
Well,
besides
go ahead.
Eggplant parmesan, like maybe ratatouille or some other basic dish with eggplant.
Well, now, you may have missed the show where I admitted that I have terrible eggplant karma. And I believe that there are people who were born with great eggplant karma, and there were people who, like me, who just missed that part of the eggplant gene. And I love eggplant. Don't misunderstand me. When other people make it, I adore it. I have written some very successful recipes for eggplant. But when an eggplant sees me, something happens to it. But this is what I've learned about eggplant. First of all, the long, narrow Japanese eggplants or Asian eggplants seem to not have as much bitterness as the globe ones. The other thing is, no matter what the recipe says to you, you salt that sucker and you press it and you get all of any potentially unpleasant juice out of it. Now, as far as great eggplant recipes, one of the all-time great recipes is done in Sicily. Have you ever had caponata?
No.
Ah, this is like an eggplant relish, and my mouth is watering at the thought of it. You do a small dice of the eggplant, and you salt it, and you press it. You know, I put it between layers of paper towel, and I pile cutting boards on top of it or cans of things, you know, just to get – and I leave that for a couple of hours. But you brown the eggplant with lots of onion and celery and a bit of carrot until everything – and in a generous amount of olive oil. And this is served at room temperature. As something that you would have as an antipasto, or you would pile it on you know, roasted bread that you've put garlic and olive oil on. It's that kind of thing. I toss this with pasta. It's absolutely incredible. So this is what you do. You brown that in a big skillet, and then you add to it. You add garlic, a ton of that. You add basil, you add oregano. And then what you add is vinegar, and you boil down that vinegar to almost nothing. And you want like a half a cup. And then you throw in tomatoes and whole olives, which you could have pitted or not, but, you know, really good, good imported olives, and some raisins and some hot pepper, not a lot, but, you know, a little bit, a generous amount of black pepper. You already have salt in there, I'm assuming. And you let that cook until just everything should be holding its shape, but it's so tender it almost melts in your mouth. And the final effect should be sweet, tart, and very rich tasting. And that eggplant becomes like meat in this dish. It's called campanada. It's a great classic. It's worth the plane ride to Palermo just to sit and eat this at a sidewalk cafe with a glass of wine. So that's
terrific.
That is my contribution, David, to the whole eggplant pantheon of brilliance. Because beyond that, ask me about onions, but eggplant, no.
Great.
Okay?
Thanks, Lynn.
Oh, hey, thank you. And interesting question, sir.
God bless you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You take care, David.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Glorious abundance is, I guess, the best way to put it for those of us who are perhaps more generously proportioned. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. I know people can be obsessed with sushi, with getting the very freshest product that they can, but usually they're talking the fish. Doug Lambrecht took a whole other route. Doug, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
So where did your sushi obsession take you?
Oh, gosh, Lynn, it started about almost 30-some-odd years ago. In the early 70s, I lived in New York and was exposed to sushi. And loved it, loved sashimi. At that time, there were literally only a handful of stores in the New York metropolitan area that served sushi. And, of course, I was exposed to wasabi early on and enjoyed it. About 15 years ago, I was kicking around on the Internet, and much to my shock, I discovered that authentic wasabi, the plant name is Wasabia japonica, is actually a very interesting and rare medicinal plant. So I started being a kind of an armchair horticulturist. I started trying to grow it and propagate it in a greenhouse in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Met with some success, although it was counterintuitive because South Carolina is quite hot and wasabi is a mountain plant that likes cold climates. But I met with enough success to be encouraged, and being an unapologetic capitalist, I decided that there was a business opportunity, so that eventually led to opening up a food company. And the more I explored wasabi, both from a medicinal and from a culinary side, the more fascinated I became. And as you correctly point out, it became something of an obsession.
So you actually grow the root. Now, is it a root?
Well, it is a thickened rhizome. A lot of people refer to it as a root, but it's actually a thickened stem. And it's the part of the plant that stores the phytonutrients for propagation or for reproductive purposes. So we actually grow Wasabia japonica in our mountain streams and in terrace beds that are fed by spring water. The kind of wasabi we grow is called Sawa wasabi, and it's the most, and that's not the cultivar, that's the method of growing. It means water grown in Japanese, and it is the most revered type of wasabi for its clean, fresh taste.
Now, is this going to taste like the wasabi paste that we normally get with our sushi?
Well, Lynn, the sad truth is that 95-some-odd% of the wasabi sold, certainly in America and probably in the world, is not wasabi at all. It's fake. It's made from horseradish and green food coloring. And we refer to it as, faux wasabi. And, faux wasabi, wasabi is often equated with Japanese horseradish, but there's no such thing as Japanese horseradish.
Uh-huh.
So our way of saying it is wasabi is not horseradish of a different color. It's an entirely different plant.
So does the real thing have that kind of sinus-clearing quality?
Yes and no. They are cousins in the brassica plant family. But as you probably know, horseradish will assault your sinuses and leave a kind of a lasting, not terribly long, but a lasting burn.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wasabi has a gentler heat. It does give you a bit of a rush, but the heat quickly dissipates, and you're left with a clean, kind of a nuanced and layered flavor in the back of your mouth with a little touch of sweetness. And it's a much more of a complex flavor than horseradish. Horseradish is very linear.
That's interesting because it sounds like it would really be delicious with fish. Hey, Doug, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Doug Lambert is a wasabi farmer in North Carolina and creator of Real Wasabi Food Products. Well, thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Jose Simon. He said, in Mexico, we have a word for sushi. It's bait. Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room and Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find invaluable newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information on our new book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. It's a collection of some of our favorite no-fail recipes, trenchant tips, and stories from some of our favorite guests. Check it all out, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.